John III was such a bashful wooer that to speed things up, Junior gave him the key to a private cottage at Seal Harbor and encouraged him to take Blanchette there. The couple were finally married on November 11, 1932, before 2,500 guests at the Riverside Church. During their courtship at Seal Harbor, Blanchette learned just how guilt-ridden John was when he handed her a comprehensive list of his faults, then asked her to reciprocate. She saw that her future husband was bowed beneath the weight of the family name and fortune, and she helped him to strike out on his own. It was not easy. Like his Aunt Edith, John III had suffered from intermittent bouts of agoraphobia in school, a condition that worsened after his marriage. When he and Blanchette went into society, he occasionally submitted to dizzy spells that nearly sent him into a dead swoon. Though the condition eventually subsided, as long as it lasted, John and Blanchette seldom ventured out to public functions. The least known of the brothers, John was the most conscientious philanthropist. Besides the Rockefeller Foundation, he chaired Lincoln Center and the Population Council, and became the most significant force behind the Asia Society. Avoiding limousines and luxury hotels whenever possible, and often traveling under the fictitious name John Davison, he refrained from any self-aggrandizement. Oddly, like his father, John could not abide his wife's fondness for modern art, and, taking a leaf from Abbey, Blanchette firmly defied him and became president of the Museum of Modern Art. Also like his father, John reacted to the controversial Rockefeller legacy by acquiring a conscience that was a punishing taskmaster. His daughter said, "He was someone who suffered from never doing things just for enjoyment." If John III seemed imprisoned by the abundant family rules, Nelson seemed heedless of the inhibitions that ruled their father's life. Nelson's brash exuberance only sapped John's confidence further. As the latter recorded in his diary, "Nelson dances very well. I am rotten. Nelson always makes a big hit." While his brothers were rangy, the young Nelson had Junior's short square frame. Named after Senator Aldrich, he inherited the Aldrich charm and extroversion, and alone of the six children, he exhibited a flamboyant craving for publicity, a cheerful egotism in a family that frowned on self-assertion. A naturally commanding figure, Nelson behaved less like a student at the Lincoln School, where he zipped about in a flashy Ford Roadster, than a principal. He accosted one startled new teacher with an invitation to call on him if she needed any information, because, "You're new here and I've been around for quite a while." Not since Big Bill had there been such a fun-loving, narcissistic Rockefeller. Junior often winced at Nelson's cocky antics, while Abby strongly identified with his frank and outspoken nature and clearly favored him over the other children. A popular student at Dartmouth, Nelson made the soccer team and was elected vice president of his junior class. Even then, he was ingratiating himself with people, sharpening his political skills. With his worn corduroy pants and sagging sweaters, he tried to blend into the crowd, but he was a star in sackcloth and converted the Dartmouth president, Ernest Hopkins, into a pal. He did not drink, taught a Sunday school class, got high enough grades to make Phi Beta Kappa, and humbly rode a bike instead of a car. After his parents scotched his dream of becoming an architect, Nelson majored in economics. For his honors thesis, he wanted to write an essay that would vindicate his grandfather and Standard Oil, and was eager to hear the story from the patriarch's own lips. A wonderful raconteur about so many events, Rockefeller carefully avoided serious discussion of his business history. "I was thinking the other day that Grandfather has never mentioned the company to us," Nelson wrote to his father, "nor has he ever told us anything about his stupendous work in organizing the company and leading it for so many years." To remedy this omission, Nelson asked if his father could set up a talk, saying it would be an outstanding and unforgettable experience in our lives. While Rockefeller mulled this over, Junior mailed his son the hagiographic Inglis manuscript, which Nelson found engrossing. It was thrilling, he told Junior. For the first time, I felt that I really knew Grandfather a little, got a glimpse into the power and grandeur of his life. Nelson did not realize that he was only reading a pretty family fiction. The Rockefeller children were being duped inadvertently by family public relations. As for Rockefeller, though flattered by the request, he declined to speak to his grandson, leaving Nelson, like Junior and the other Rockefellers, no better informed about Standard Oil than any well-read stranger. Senior's behavior guaranteed that anxiety over the fortune's legitimacy would spread to his descendants, strengthening their guilty consciences. In his thesis, Nelson, coached by Inglis, flatly denied that Standard Oil ever drove competitors from business unfairly. These companies were treated with extreme fairness and in many cases with generosity, he wrote, dismissing as mythical that Standard Oil had amassed power through local price discrimination, bogus independence, and espionage. In 1929, Nelson turned 21 on the same day that Rockefeller reached 90. The 90 makes my 21 seem mighty small and insignificant, he wrote his parents, just like a little sapling standing by a mighty fir. But the sapling still has time to grow and develop, and someday it might itself turn into a tree of some merit. Who knows? Nelson leaped at any chance to golf with Rockefeller in Florida and was an attentive audience for his yarns and witticisms. After one 1932 visit, Nelson told Junior that Rockefeller certainly is an extraordinary man, about the finest I know. There are few people that I really admire as being all-around success, but he leads the list. His point of view and outlook on life are so perfectly grand, and what a sense of humor. In the autumn of 1929, in his can-do, take-charge style, Nelson declared that he would marry a childhood friend, Mary Todd Hunter Clark, known as Todd. Thin and aristocratic in manner, she was a granddaughter of George Roberts, a former president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Junior was irate that Nelson had not consulted him and consented only after Abby lobbied him. Nelson and Todd went to Ormond Beach to see Rockefeller, who gave his blessing after golfing with this young lady from the mainline suburbs of Philadelphia. Todd struck observers as witty and intelligent, an excellent mimic and fine sportswoman, if rather cool and self-contained. On June 30, 1930, Nelson married her in Bala-Cynwyd, Pennsylvania, while police restrained 1,000 spectators outside. At the last minute, Rockefeller could not come and sent $20,000 in securities instead. More and more, he refrained from trips that might threaten his health. For their honeymoon, Nelson and Todd spent 2 weeks in Seal Harbor, where they were attended by 24 servants. As a wedding gift, Junior treated them to a 9-month around-the-world trip that took on the trappings of a state visit. At each port of call, they were escorted by Standard Oil officials who introduced them to prime ministers and other dignitaries. For Nelson, the meeting with Mahatma Gandhi in India had one severe shortcoming. "He showed no interest in me whatever," he complained. During the summer of 1931, Nelson started work at 26 Broadway, where he felt crowded out by Junior's phalanx of advisors. In an abortive venture, he launched a company for marketing merchandise and discussed the project at length with Rockefeller in Florida. "Every morning we'd take turns reading Psalms before breakfast, which consisted of floods of orange juice," said Nelson. He made his mark by hustling tenants for Rockefeller Center and ended up as the project's chief panjandrum. During his eventful career, he served as an Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America under Roosevelt and Undersecretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under Eisenhower. When sworn in as Governor of New York in 1959, he took the oath of office on the Bible of his great-grandmother Eliza. After 30 years and 5 children, the marriage to Todd ended in divorce in 1962. When he married Margaretta Happy Murphy the following year, many people thought his marital history had irreparably harmed his presidential ambitions, and he had to settle for the vice presidency under Gerald Ford. When Lawrence, L-A-U-R-A-N-C-E, was born in 1910, the family chose this strange spelling of his name to honor the ailing city. "This we do so as to make it as much like Laura as possible," Junior told his mother. Everybody said the thin, sharp-featured Lawrence looked more like Senior than any of the other children did. Bright and laconic, with an incisive wit, he also had his grandfather's enigmatic detachment. However, he lacked the power to concentrate on difficult and routine tasks, as Junior said when Lawrence was at the Lincoln School. The boy took up photography, built a wooden auto powered by a motorcycle engine, and showed a flair for gadgetry. As a philosophy major at Princeton, Lawrence shed many of his boyhood religious beliefs in the face of rational scrutiny. While studying at Harvard Law School, he developed pneumonia during his first semester and had to spend the winter with Senior at Ormond Beach. Because he had qualms about the social philosophy of the law and had to struggle to get through his finals, he decided to drop out without taking his degree. In 1934, Lawrence married Mary French in Woodstock, Vermont. A charming Vassar graduate of quiet strength, Mary was the granddaughter of Frederick Billings, a president of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Mary's brother had roomed with Nelson at Dartmouth. Lawrence had his grandfather's sound instinct for business opportunities and the same unwavering confidence in his own judgment. When he inherited Rockefeller's New York Stock Exchange seat, he became the youngest member of the exchange. At 28, with his friend Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, Lawrence joined a syndicate to buy Eastern Airlines, eventually becoming its largest shareholder. He also took a sizable stake in the McDonnell Aircraft Corporation, which surged ahead on the strength of aviation contracts during World War II. He was later involved in the Viking rocket and other aerospace projects, and enjoyed flying his own plane. After the family made its first trip to the Grand Tetons in the early 1920s, he became entranced by conservation no less than his father had been. "I was the youngest one there, and therefore the most impressionable," he said. He later created vacation resorts in places of unspoiled scenery, managing them through a company called Rock Resorts that eventually owned some of the world's most gorgeous vacation spots. Winthrop's life nearly started out with an embarrassing blunder. Junior and Abby were about to christen him Winthrop Aldrich Rockefeller, after Abby's brother, when they realized what his initials would spell and scrapped the middle name. He was a chubby, maladroit boy who bore the brunt of Nelson and Lawrence's sadistic urges. When he developed kidney trouble, his two older brothers considerately reminded him that another young cousin named Winthrop had died of kidney disease. Abby felt protective toward her vulnerable son and once said of him, "Abuse only makes him angry and much worse, while for love and kind treatment he will do anything." There was something ineffably sad about Winthrop's youth. Squirming under his father's stern rigor, he longed for escape to a less taxing world. Easily distracted, he did poorly at Lincoln and Loomis, where he enjoyed playing practical jokes and chasing girls. A big, handsome, hulking boy, at 16 he was 6'1" and weighed 185 pounds, he lacked the energy and drive that came so effortlessly to his more dynamic brothers. Winthrop later admitted that as a Yale undergraduate he had mastered only two subjects, how to smoke and how to drink. At first he could not keep down more than three drinks without getting sick. "Unfortunately, I later got over that." At Yale he played cards and, committing one of the cardinal Rockefeller sins, began to neglect his account book. In the middle of his freshman year, Winthrop realized that his prodigality might cost him his allowance, and he negotiated a large rescue loan from Babs. During the 1933 summer vacation, he toiled as a roustabout in the Texas oil fields for Humble Oil, which was now owned by Jersey Standard, and he felt more at home doing manual work among these rough, simple men than he had among his Yale classmates. "That was what I had been looking for. Men working with their hands, producing something real. I was fascinated by everything I saw, I wanted to become part of it, to do what they were doing, to prove to myself that I was as good a man as any of them. If a tonic for his morale, the Texas adventure did not enhance his school performance, and he continued to favor booze and cards. At one point, while Winthrop was in Texas, a New Haven publican named Curly Levine made the mistake of sending him a telegram at West 54th Street. Junior read the message and secretly contacted Yale president James R. Angel, who informed him that Curly was mixed up with gambling and shady elements. When confronted, Winthrop broke down and confessed to his horrified parents. "Curly is a Jewish bartender in a speakeasy in New Haven where I have gotten liquor while I was at college." In his junior year, Winthrop was expelled from college after being discovered in the shower with a young lady. After Yale, Winthrop resumed work for Humble Oil in the Texas fields. When he announced the news, Rockefeller, whatever his reservations, expressed pleasure at a family member being back on the Standard Oil payroll. When Winthrop visited Lakewood to tell him about Humble's advanced production methods in Texas, the old man listened patiently, then said, "Well, brother, I appreciate that, but I must remind you that the important thing is the figures." In his amiability, Winthrop reminded people of Rockefeller, and perhaps for that reason he was very sensitive to the contradictions of the old man's personality. "There was always an indefinable aloofness, a detachment that I cannot describe. He was warm, human, and real. His every act was an act of warmth. And yet this other quality was there." The other brothers did not see this subtle discrepancy between the inner and outer man. For 3 years, Winthrop enjoyed the camaraderie of the Texas roustabouts and smoked, drank, and philandered. Winthrop was "big and broad-shouldered, like a friendly young koala," said one contemporary magazine writer. In this schizoid existence, he worked and ate with other workers during the week and lived on 75 cents an hour, then dined on weekends at a country club with the company president. Winthrop welcomed his transient experience of ordinariness in Texas. As he once noted with regret, "If your name is Rockefeller, you can almost feel the prices rise when you walk into a store." Returning to New York, Winthrop trained at the Chase National Bank, worked for the Soconi Vacuum Oil Company, the former Standard Oil of New York, and served as a vice chairman of the Greater New York Fund. These jobs drew less press attention than his evening prowls through cafe society. As one reporter remarked, Winthrop "handled all the nightlife for the Rockefellers." As his drinking and womanizing crept into gossip columns, Junior scolded him, but Winthrop resented his father's autocratic manner and attempt to perpetuate what seemed an obsolete way of life. After one quarrel, Winthrop said bitterly, "By God, if I ever have children, I'm going to talk to them, not just make an appointment to see them and then get up after 5 minutes to go get a haircut." In 1948, after dating actress Mary Martin, Winthrop married a voluptuous blonde named Barbara Bobo Sears, née Yevuta Palokuta, the daughter of Lithuanian immigrants. Junior and Abby boycotted the Florida wedding, and the marriage scarcely lasted the year. When Winthrop later bought a large spread, Winrock Farm, in Arkansas, Junior found one excuse after another not to visit. Much to the surprise of his family, Winthrop was elected Arkansas governor in 1966, the first Republican to manage that feat in 94 years. Like Winthrop, David was pudgy as a child but was spared the rough attention of his older brothers. Like a miniature banker, he moved with serene self-confidence and punctiliously kept his account books. Smart, docile, and cherubically round-faced, he was adored by Rockefeller, who loved to croon carols with him at the casements. As Rockefeller told his son after one of David's holiday visits, "He is a worthy son of worthy parents, and his grandfather dotes on him." David reciprocated the affection, calling his grandfather "the least doer man I've ever known, constantly smiling, joking, and telling shaggy dog stories." Senior once told John Yorty that David was the grandchild who most resembled him. As the youngest son, David was solitary, yet he compensated for this by creating a self-contained world, collecting butterflies, moths, beetles, and grasshoppers. Eventually, he developed a world-famous trove of 40,000 beetles. By the time he graduated from the Lincoln School, he was, like Rockefeller, outwardly genial and inwardly reserved. Steady and methodical, he experienced no scandals or crises at Harvard, graduating cum laude in 1936, after having written his senior thesis on Fabian socialism. After a postgraduate year at Harvard and another at the London School of Economics, he completed a doctorate in economics at the University of Chicago. Though his thesis, Unused Resources and Economic Waste, dealt with issues of corporate concentration that had preoccupied his grandfather, David arrived at free market conclusions and criticized monopolies as counterproductive. While paying tribute to Standard Oil for imposing order on an anarchic industry, he agreed with the court's 1911 decision to break up the trust. As he later argued, some units of Standard Oil are now bigger and better than grandfather could ever have imagined even the whole company would be. This preference for neoclassical economics reflected changes both in the Rockefeller family and in the American business community. Upon leaving Chicago, David worked for 18 months as an unpaid secretary to Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia of New York. He had the wisdom to marry a feisty, red-blooded woman, Margaret Peggy McGrath, who complemented his more detached personality. She came from a comfortable but not blue-ribbon family and had little tolerance for grandiosity like Nelson's. With a sometimes fiery temper and activist bent, she donated her time to worthwhile causes, including saving the Maine shoreline, raising cattle, and working on behalf of farmland conservation. David dedicated his career to the Chase Manhattan Bank, rising to the chairman's post and becoming an eminent peripatetic international banker. As he told an interviewer, he was the first member of the family since grandfather who has had a regular job in a company and has devoted a major part of his time to being in business. Chapter 35. See You in Heaven. The world's richest man never lost the thrifty boyhood habits that had made him the nonpareil of American business. One day at Ormond Beach, he was studying the blazing hearth when he turned to Michael, the butler, and asked, "How long are those sticks of wood?" 14 inches, Michael replied. "Do you think they would do just as well if they were cut 12 inches in length?" Michael conceded this was possible. "Then the next time the wood is being sawed, have it made 12 inches in length." Since 12 inches gave sufficient light and heat at less expense, it became the new household standard. His frugality was deeply rooted. One Christmas he was delighted when his son gave him 2 dozen golf balls and some fountain pens, his idea of wonderfully practical gifts. Rockefeller had now lived so long and grown so famous that a number of promoters sought to cash in on his fame. In 1930, Sarah S. Denon, secretary of the Coney Island Chamber of Commerce in Brooklyn, New York, tracked down the Richford House in which the Titan had been born. Wind now blew through the chinks of this tottering, clabbered dwelling. She had a vision of sudden riches. She would dismantle the house and ship it to Coney Island, where an estimated 5 million annual paying customers would tour this new shrine of American capitalism. Cringing at the thought, Rockefeller took legal steps to stop the commercialization of his name. After Denon had bought and dismembered the structure, Rockefeller's lawyers marshaled state and local authorities to prevent the house from moving over public highways. The heap of numbered planks made it only as far as Binghamton. During the Wall Street boom of the 1920s, Rockefeller took a guilty thrill in playing the stock market, despite Junior's reproaches. If his son was present when somebody alluded to his trading, Rockefeller, like a naughty child, would shift the subject. As the market surged, he jovially passed out dollar bills as bull market dividends to companions. After breakfast, he often announced, "Well, I guess I'll see what I can do to keep the wolf away from the door." then scurried over to his office to get fresh quotes by telephone or telegraph. When the market either swooped or soared, a messenger tracked Rockefeller down on the golf course to deliver a folded sheet with share prices. Aside from cash, railroad securities, U.S. bonds, and Wall Street loans, Rockefeller retained most of his money in Standard Oil companies and could quote the precise number of shares he held in each of his stocks, even when they ran to five digits. Partial to old habits, Rockefeller continued to trade by buying each time a stock declined an eighth of a point or selling on each eighth point rise. Having relinquished most of his money to Junior, he often borrowed up to $20 million to execute these transactions, and occasionally cadged loans from his son. "John," he said to him one day, "I've been following the stock market carefully. I think that if I had a little money, I could use it to make some more. Do you believe you could lend me several hundred thousand dollars?" "Well, father," said Junior wryly, "do you think you are old enough to use it wisely?" The Rockefellers fared handsomely in the effervescent market of the Roaring Twenties. As the market soared, Junior more than doubled the $450 million he had received, and his assets approached the billion-dollar mark. When the market crashed in October 1929, the Rockefellers were caught by surprise. Ivy Lee convinced Junior of the publicity value of a calming statement from his father. After buying 1 million shares of Standard of New Jersey, Rockefeller issued a press release that had been scripted by Lee. "These are days when many are discouraged. In the 90 years of my life, depressions have come and gone. Prosperity has always returned and will again." In his peroration, he said, "Believing that the fundamental conditions of the country are sound, my son and I have been purchasing sound common stocks for some days." When the comedian Eddie Cantor was informed that the Rockefellers had resumed buying stocks, he responded with the wisecrack, "Sure, who else had any money left?" After the crash, Junior and Tom Debevoise worried about the financial health of the Equitable Trust, which had operated under Rockefeller control since 1911. They plucked Abby's brother, Winthrop Aldrich, from the law firm of Murray Aldrich and Webb, and placed him in charge of the Equitable. A few months later, Aldrich orchestrated a merger with Chase National, creating the world's largest bank, and one henceforth referred to as the Rockefeller Bank. Even though the descendants of James Stillman and William Rockefeller steered the rival National City Bank. Some years later, Aldrich also effected a merger of his old law firm with that of Burt Milbank, Junior's old friend from the Browning School, to form the firm known today as Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy, which would be closely associated with the Rockefellers. Junior was dispatched to Chicago to salvage what he could from the wreckage of Edith's business affairs, which did not endear him to Edith, who saw this as more high-handed meddling. At Junior's behest, she moved from her lakeshore mansion into a suite at the Drake Hotel, where she was provided with a family allowance. Then in early 1930, she was diagnosed with cancer in her right breast and underwent a mastectomy and radiation therapy. While convalescing, she tried to stave off bankruptcy by selling her pearls and emeralds to Cartier for nearly $1 million, begging Junior for a $1 million loan for her real estate business, and asking her father to buy the Villa Turicum for more than $2 million. Having had more than enough, Rockefeller declined to advance her additional money. In 1932, after she developed a chronic cough, doctors found a dark spot on Edith's lower ribs. She tried to no avail to cure this cancer through psychological techniques. Until the end, she promised that she would try to see her father, but these ritual assertions had become a polite fiction between them. Her children and even her ex-husband Harold made repeated visits to her bedside. On August 25, 1932, Edith died in her suite at the Drake Hotel. For all her unconventional ideas, Edith had never renounced the possibility that Harold would leave Ganovalska and return. Like an old-fashioned wife, she had long kept his room at 1000 Lakeshore Drive untouched, with the furniture unchanged and his clothes hanging in the closet. It was a strange clutch of pallbearers who carried her coffin to the grave. Harold, Fowler, Junior, and Edvin Krenn. When Junior tried to exclude Krenn from the funeral, Harold, in deference to Edith, overrode his objections. In her will, Edith left more money to Krenn, 5/12 of her estate, than to any of her three children. The Rockefeller lawyers furiously battled the bequest to Krenn until he capitulated and settled for a $24,000 annuity for life. At the news of her death, James Joyce struck a belated note of forgiveness. "I'm sorry to learn of the death of Mrs. McCormick," he told a friend. "She was very kind to me at a difficult moment and was a woman of considerable distinction." For all his financial savvy, Senior was democratically dragged down in the crash along with lesser mortals, and saw his rump fortune of $25 million dwindle to a mere $7 million, prompting grandson Winthrop to exclaim, "For grandfather, that was being practically broke." In 1932, in a passing persnickety moment, Rockefeller told Debevoise that Junior should give him $3.5 million as an equitable adjustment for all the money he had spent on the Rockefeller family office during the previous 10 years. Rockefeller soon retracted his request, but his momentary pique showed that he was unnerved by his thin cushion of cash. Junior also had unaccustomed money worries after the crash, as his net worth was slashed from almost $1 billion in 1929 to less than $500 million in 1934. The damage to his annual income was still more savage. From a peak of $56.7 million in the 1920s, it dropped to $16.5 million by the second year of the New Deal. Because he had made so many charitable pledges during the 1920s boom, his expenditures began to outpace his income by the early 1930s. Right before Roosevelt's inauguration, Junior had to liquidate large positions of Standard of New Jersey and Indiana and borrow almost $8 million to meet prior commitments. Throughout the Roosevelt years, the Rockefellers struggled with an ideological dilemma. As long-time donors to Republican causes, they found much of the New Deal abominable and feared, like many other rich Americans, that Roosevelt was giving away the country. At the same time, they had a patrician sense of obligation toward the poor. While Hoover was still president, Senior and Junior gave $2 million to the Emergency Unemployment Relief, a private charity. When Roosevelt became president in 1933, Rockefeller was nudged by his son into issuing a patriotic statement in praise of the courage and progressive leadership of President Roosevelt. Setting an amusing example of austerity for the masses, he started to give out nickels instead of dimes. In 1933, Junior even broadcast a radio appeal for the ultra-liberal National Industrial Recovery Act. Yet despite the lip service paid to Roosevelt's policies, the Rockefellers continued to prefer private charity to public works programs. At Pocantico, Junior charted 50 miles of new carriage trails to create extra jobs and gave generously to the American Red Cross and other relief agencies. Senior quickly cooled on the New Deal, and when the Social Security Act was enacted in 1935, he was sure it would destroy America's moral fiber. As Junior's net worth tumbled after the crash, he began to feel the financial strain of Colonial Williamsburg and a new real estate project in Midtown Manhattan that was at first known as Metropolitan Square. With this last project, Junior became entangled in the sort of high-stakes maneuvering that had distinguished his father's career but had played no part in his own. The genesis of the project dated back to 1928, when the Metropolitan Opera Company decided to abandon its old quarters and create a new opera house on a site owned by Columbia University between 48th and 51st Streets and 5th and 6th Avenues. Flanked by the 6th Avenue elevated train and studded with speakeasies, pawn shops, bars, and other such sleazy haunts, the area was an unlikely choice for an opulent new opera house. Otto Kahn, a Kuhn Loeb partner and chairman of the Metropolitan Opera Company, convinced Junior that he could render a community service and turn a tidy profit, an irresistible combination for a Rockefeller, By leasing the surrounding parcels from Columbia and building a showcase setting for the opera. After Charles O. Hite canvassed 5 real estate experts, Junior, seized by an impulse and without consulting a lawyer, authorized Hite to close the deal with Columbia for a lease that would cost more than $3 million per year. The Metropolitan Opera could not fetch a high enough price for its old building to construct a new one, and suggested to Junior that he pay for half the cost of its new $8 million home. Feeling used and blackmailed, Junior turned them down, and when the Metropolitan Opera withdrew from the project, he was suddenly saddled with 229 shabby old brownstones amid the worsening economic environment. Without the opera, the development seemed to lose both its centerpiece and raison d'etre, yet bills kept pouring in. And by the spring of 1930, Junior had paid out $10 million. Each year he was liable for another $4 million in leases and taxes, and the rentals scarcely covered a tenth of that amount. One option was simply to scuttle the development. But Junior had always had a nagging sense of being patronized by the business community, and perhaps he now saw a chance for vindication, a chance to prove that he was really his father's son. In his most audacious career decision, he decided that he would personally finance a new complex of office buildings and round up the corporate tenants himself. As he persevered, he endured gales of ridicule and was even mocked in a Broadway play, as Thousands Cheer, where the hapless Junior was depicted as trying to palm off Rockefeller Center as a birthday gift on his unsuspecting father. As might be expected, Junior suffered dreadful tension and insomnia over the Midtown project. "I walk the floor nights," he told architect Wallace Harrison, "wondering where I'm going to get the money to build these buildings." A novel situation for a Rockefeller, indeed. In the spring of 1931, recognizing the telltale symptoms, doctors advised him to take a vacation with Abby in Arizona. At the Arizona Inn in Tucson, a lady sitting at a nearby table in the restaurant waved to Junior, and only later did he discover that it was Ida Tarbell. By the 1920s, her famous history of the Standard Oil Company could be found only in second-hand bookstores, and when reissued in 1925, it failed to sell. Returning to New York, Junior endured a debilitating case of shingles, which the doctors blamed on nervous exhaustion. He was also suffering such frequent colds that tests were performed at the Rockefeller Institute to see whether a serum could be developed from his germs that might prevent future colds. Despite his medical problems, Junior displayed a new toughness in dealing with the Midtown complex. First, he had to settle the vexed question of a name to supersede the now obsolete Metropolitan Square. Like his father, Junior hesitated to employ the Rockefeller name, but a team of advisors, from Ivy Lee to Sun Nelson to managing agent John Todd, convinced him that Rockefeller Center would be the most potent marketing tool, an indication of how far the family image had advanced since the dark days of the Muckrakers. To lend the complex a forward-looking image, the managers decided to create a Radio City as its linchpin. In July 1931, after RCA, NBC, and Radio Keith Orpheum, RKO, agreed to lease 1 million square feet of office space for $3 million a year, Junior broke ground on the first of 14 projected buildings. Junior supervised Rockefeller Center with a command he had never shown before in any money-making venture. Each morning, he arrived at work by 8 o'clock, a golden 5-foot ruler wedged into his back pocket. Taking huge blueprints off the table, he would unroll them on the floor and crawl about, taking measurements with his ruler. Construction during the Depression had distinct advantages, most notably in lower costs for labor and building materials, and Rockefeller Center provided work for 75,000 unionized building workers. From the outset, Junior told John Todd that the cluster of buildings had to be architecturally distinguished and harmonious. Wallace Harrison, who had studied at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, and his colleagues, turned to European modernism to endow Rockefeller Center with a sleek, futuristic look. Junior's one and quite major concession to contemporary taste had a canny commercial rationale behind it. Had the design of the complex been stodgy and old-fashioned, it would have undercut the Radio City marketing approach and the technologically advanced aura of the project. Ornamented with Art Deco motifs, the tapering towers of Indiana limestone, steel, glass, and masonry shot 850 feet into the air, yet were spaced widely enough to create an airy sensation at plaza level. Though critics eventually labeled Rockefeller Center the world's finest skyscraper ensemble, they almost universally carped at it at its inception. To lend artistic distinction to the project, Diego Rivera was commissioned to paint a mural for the prestige spot in the RCA building lobby. Despite his left-wing politics, Abbey had bought Rivera's watercolors, exhibited his frescoes at MoMA, and invited him and his wife, Frida Kahlo, to 10 West 54th Street. Nelson negotiated the coveted commission, and the Rockefeller Center overseers chose a suitably momentous and ostensibly non-controversial theme. Man at the crossroads, looking with hope and high vision to the choosing of a new and better future. In the spring of 1933, Rivera began to sketch his vision of capitalist society as a diseased world of brutalized workers and scrofulous card-playing capitalists, contrasting it with a hopeful, revolutionary world symbolized by red flags and crowned by Lenin's saintly visage. His wife and assistants begged him to delete the head of the Bolshevik leader, but Rivera was determined to épater les bourgeois, and the press gloated over the Rockefeller predicament. Rivera perpetrates scenes of communist activity for RCA walls, and Rockefeller foots the bill, one paper said. After Rivera refused to delete Lenin's head, he was paid in full and dismissed from the job. He had told Nelson that he preferred the destruction of his piece to any tampering with it, and his mural was, in fact, reluctantly dismantled. The picture was obscene and, in the judgment of Rockefeller Center, an offense to good taste, Junior hastily explained to his father. It was for this reason primarily that Rockefeller Center decided to destroy it. With the completion of the RCA building in 1933, Junior moved the Rockefeller family offices from 26th Broadway to the 56th floor of the new skyscraper. Henceforth, Room 5600 would be the seat of the Rockefeller Empire, with several hundred employees. Nelson, who was still in his 20s, got a real estate license and soon became a frenetic salesman for empty office space at Rockefeller Center. To woo tenants, he offered attractive rents and agreed to assume their old leases. Several companies in the Rockefeller fold, including Standard Oil of New Jersey, Saucony Vacuum, Standard Oil of California, and Chase National Bank, took space in the new Midtown complex. In 1938, the first year it turned a profit, Nelson was named president of Rockefeller Center. By the time Junior hammered in the last of some 10 million rivets in 1939, he had transformed the project from the butt of malicious jokes into one of the Depression's outstanding business triumphs. Even as his son created one city in Midtown Manhattan and recreated another in Williamsburg, Virginia, Rockefeller remained curiously indifferent toward the urban complex that would so lastingly perpetuate his name. Amazingly enough, he probably never set foot in Rockefeller Center. He wasn't interested in things of that sort, said Junior, and I don't think we ever discussed Williamsburg and seldom discussed Rockefeller Center. He was broad-minded and tolerant, but this kind of thing didn't enter his life. He might conceivably have asked about questions of financing or labor troubles at Rockefeller Center or Williamsburg, but that would be the only type of question that he would be interested in. Senior might have followed its progress more closely than Junior realized, for Nelson remembered him waking from a nap, motioning him over to his Morris chair, and firing penetrating, detailed questions about the Midtown project. Nevertheless, absorbed with his own creations, Rockefeller tended to screen out his son's accomplishments and overlook what he himself had not initiated. For all that, Junior remained slavishly devoted to his father. A wire that he sent on the eve of a visit seems to sum up this reverence. "Am not coming because I think you need me, but because I know I need you." In his 90s, Rockefeller radiated the cheer of an elder statesman. The spindly little man weighed less than 100 pounds and looked as if he had been shrunk by a witch doctor. He was scarcely affected by the recrudescence of Rockefeller-baiting books that appeared in the left-wing atmosphere of the Depression. In such polemics as The Robber Barons by Matthew Josephson, critics returned to the view popularized by Henry Demarest Lloyd and Ida Tarbell that Rockefeller had been the greatest corporate brigand of his day and owed his success to his ruthlessness and dishonesty, not to his business acumen. Yet this resurgence of old resentments was short-lived. The surge of patriotic feeling that accompanied World War II led to a renewed appreciation of the iron men of American industry who had bequeathed such military might to the country, a view very much in evidence in the authorized two-volume biography of Rockefeller that was published by Columbia University historian Alan Nevins in 1940 and in revised form in 1953. Rockefeller was always either lionized or vandalized according to the temper of the times. Still vigorous, Rockefeller could send a golf ball sailing 165 yards down the fairway. In 1930, he marched through 6 holes in 25 shots. Then his strength began to wane, and he gradually had to curtail his game. With typical precision, he reduced his number of daily holes from 6 to 4 to 2. After contracting a severe cold in 1932, he had to abandon golf altogether. The 93-year-old Rockefeller bounced back from this ill health with renewed good humor. One paper reported, "He was so delighted to be out in the warm sunshine again that once he stopped and sang a hymn as he gazed with twinkling eyes at the myriad of brilliant flowers and shrubs." He reiterated his wish to live to 100, viewing it as God's final verdict on his life. "Many folks believe I've done much harm in the world," he told Ormond Beach's mayor, George N. Rigby. "But on the other hand, I've tried to do what good I could, and I really would like to live to be 100. As Rigby described it, Rockefeller grew even more detached from material things as he approached the end of life. "I recall one day we were sitting on his front porch at Ormond watching a most elaborate yacht winding its way down the Halifax River toward Palm Beach. He expressed his wonder at the possible pleasure a man could get out of such show and pretension. Then, after a moment or two, the whole expression of his face changed, and he asked enthusiastically, 'Wasn't that a beautiful rain we had last night?'" Rockefeller's improbable love affair with the movie camera flourished. In 1930, he was invited to attend festivities in Cleveland to celebrate the 60th anniversary of Standard Oil of Ohio. Too frail to go, he agreed to shoot a newsreel that would be shown at the celebration. Sitting on his sunlit porch as the cameras rolled, Rockefeller delivered a congratulatory message in a thin voice. And the gesture of his removing his glasses when he finished reading and turned to regard me where I stood behind the camera revealed a natural actor, said his hand-picked cameraman, Kurt Engelbrecht. 2 weeks later, when a Standard of Ohio executive flew down to Ormond Beach, Rockefeller was shot playing golf and greeting the executive as his plane alighted on the green. Showing surprising spunk, the 91-year-old Rockefeller boarded the airplane and was eager to fly off, cameras rolling, when his vigilant valet, John Yorty, called off the flight as subjecting him to too much excitement. In a compromise, the monoplane taxied up and down the runway, with Rockefeller inside waving to the cameras. "You make me feel like a movie actor," Rockefeller told Engelbrecht. Though free of self-pity, Rockefeller often seemed forlorn in the 1930s. Too proud to plead for visits from descendants, he dropped hints and tactful suggestions that he would like to see them more, but this did not seem to work. He craved some human warmth that he never fully got from his own family or perhaps had never really allowed to flower. Engelbrecht noted Rockefeller's strange fascination with a little girl named Lucille, who was the daughter of his chauffeur, Vincent Frasco. She somehow filled a tremendous gap for him, and it may be safely asserted that he demonstrated an affection for her that he was never known to manifest for one of his own blood. Never a day passed but she paid a visit to him or he came looking for her. In her presence everything else was forgotten. She was a charm for him. He talked with her and told her stories. His face brightened to her responses, and his eyes warmed in his glances in her direction. As the Depression progressed, Junior found himself in the same uncomfortable position that his father had been in a generation before. His children were restive and wanted him to make some final disposition of his money. It infuriated them that they were now married grown-ups, still living on allowances, who had to go hat in hand to father for a new car or trip abroad. In May 1933, Junior heard the first murmurs of outright rebellion when his children complained in a collective letter that too much of their time with him was taken up with money squabbles that jeopardized family relations, and they petitioned him for larger allowances. To mollify his mutinous offspring, Junior gave his three oldest children, Babs, John III, and Nelson, 200,000 shares of Ciccone Vacuum apiece, providing each with about $3.2 million. The following year, Congress sharply boosted tax schedules. Rates jumped for the top income bracket from 55% to 63%, while the estate tax soared from 45% to 60%, for estates valued beyond $50 million, and the gift tax rose from 33% to 45% for sums beyond $10 million. Junior decided to set up trusts for his wife and children before the steeper gift tax took effect at year's end. To safeguard this money, which would be managed by the trust department of the Chase National Bank, he stipulated that the children could draw income, but that principal withdrawals had to be approved by trustees. Junior made an invidious exception for Abby and Babs, who could not touch principal under any circumstances. Since the trustees included such intimates of Junior as Raymond Fosdick, Tom Debevoise, and Winthrop Aldrich, he did not forfeit total control. The largest single trust went to Abby, who received $18.3 million and the full freedom to purchase modern art with her income. Babs, John III, and Nelson got $12 million apiece, and Lawrence, Winthrop, and David smaller amounts. The following year, Junior added money to these last three accounts to equalize the trusts. In all, Junior transmitted $102 million, or more than $1 billion in 1996 dollars, to his wife and children through the trusts, as he explained the operating philosophy behind them to Lawrence. "They have been created in accordance with the policy which your grandfather Rockefeller adopted with his children and which I hope your children will ultimately follow. As you know, grandfather and I have always been keenly alive to the responsibilities inherent in the possession of wealth. He believes, as I do, that these responsibilities and the opportunities which they bring for useful living and unselfish service to mankind should be shared with those of the next generation when and as soon as they have reached such an age and attained such a maturity as justifies their being entrusted with them." The $102 million that Junior bequeathed to his heirs was a stupendous sum, yet it represented only a fraction of the money he had inherited. Between 1917 and 1960, Junior gave away $537 million directly, plus another $540 million indirectly through organized Rockefeller philanthropies. Junior did not leave himself a pauper. He was left with about $200 million in the 1950s, while his descendants, wisely investing their inheritances, were worth more than $6.2 billion in 1996. He also paid $317 million in taxes to federal, state, and local governments. So, whatever Rockefeller's plunder, the great bulk of the gain was ultimately plowed back into worthwhile projects and the public purse. Such was the indignation aroused by Standard Oil, however, that perhaps only generosity on this extraordinary scale could have softened memories of the raving monopolist. Rockefeller inspired many premature reports of his demise, and his habitual secrecy about his medical condition kept the press on high alert. In 1934, at 95, he suffered a bout of bronchial pneumonia that threatened to thwart his goal of reaching 100, but he managed to recover. His weight dropped below 90 pounds, and he decided to abandon Kikut for good. He loaded up a private railroad car with fruits, vegetables, cultured milk, and oxygen canisters, and traveled to the Casements, where he settled permanently. Determined to eke out 5 more years, he drastically restricted his routine to conserve energy. No more golf, no more afternoon larks in the car, no more garden walks. He took off his expensive silver wigs, never to don them again. As his pace slackened, the servants marched to his slower tempo, and a twilight hush seemed to descend over the Ormond Beach House. Watchful and alert, the wizened little man sat for hours on the sun porch. To maintain muscle tone in his legs, he mounted a stationary bicycle in his room every day and slowly cycled. When he reached 96 on July 8, 1935, his insurance company, abiding by an old custom, had to pay him $5 million, the face value of his policy. According to contemporary actuarial tables, only one person in 100,000 lived that long. Always ready to embrace change, the old man liked to watch Hollywood movies at home, especially those with shapely blondes, such as Jean Harlow. His life, however, still revolved around religion, and when he was too weak to go to church, he listened to sermons on a bedside radio. His thoughts turned toward eternity. When Henry Ford was leaving one day, Rockefeller said to him, "Goodbye, I'll see you in heaven." And Ford replied, "You will if you get in." Yet Rockefeller seemed to know for certain that the Lord was not a radical critic of society and would reward him in the hereafter. He started a new routine, singing hymns accompanied by a violinist who came to the house. For all his religious certitude, however, death remained the one unmentionable subject for Rockefeller. Never did he speak of death in relation to himself. Rather did he speak always of life, of activity, of accomplishment. In early 1937, as Rockefeller approached 98, his body was feeble but his mind was lucid. "Father is very well," Junior wrote an old friend in March 1937. "Better even than for the past year or two. We are having a delightful time here with him, and the weather is beautiful." He still gambled in stocks and enjoyed his unvarying comedy routine with Mrs. Evans. On Saturday, May 22nd, he was taking the sunlight when Evans said to him, "Mr. Rockefeller, the sun has given you some color. You look so much better." When he just flashed a wordless smile, she added, "Mr. Rockefeller, you haven't said anything about how I look." In his chair, he made a chivalric bow and said, "Mrs. Evans, that is because I am never able to do the subject justice." That same day, he paid off the mortgage of the institution that had so profoundly affected him, the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church. Before the day was over, Rockefeller had a heart attack. At 4:05 a.m. on the morning of May 23rd, he lapsed into a coma and died in his sleep. The official cause of death was sclerotic myocarditis, a hardening and inflammation of the heart wall, although it is probably more accurate to say that he died of old age. Rockefeller drifted off peacefully, 6 weeks short of his 98th birthday. His placid end disappointed critics who were still hoping for some earthly retribution. As news of Rockefeller's death spread, crowds gathered outside his compound, and the sexton of the Union Baptist Church tolled the steeple bell. After a private funeral at Ormond Beach for staff and friends, a motorcycle guard accompanied the casket to the railroad station, where it was placed on a private car for the journey northward to Pocantico. When the train arrived at Tarrytown, Junior and his 5 sons were waiting on the platform in identical Homburgs. On May 25th, the Reverend Harry Emerson Fosdick delivered a brief, touching eulogy at the Pocantico funeral, while Dr. Archer Gibson played the Kikut pipe organ. As a reminder that the deceased had never lacked detractors, state troopers scoured Pocantico Hills for trespassers as the service progressed. Around the world, employees in the offices of all Standard Oil successor firms observed 5 minutes of silence. On May 27th, Rockefeller's body returned to Cleveland and was lowered into the earth between the two Baptist women who had so devotedly believed in him, Eliza and Seti. Because of fears that vandals might desecrate the grave, Rockefeller's casket was placed in a bomb-proof tomb sealed by heavy slabs of stone. Having given away most of his money, Rockefeller left behind an estate of $26.4 million, showing that he had recouped his stock market losses after the 1929 crash. Most of his estate took the form of U.S. Treasury notes, though he had retained, for sentimental reasons, one share of Standard Oil of California, marked Certificate Number 1. The fabulous oil wealth of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait would be tapped within a year of Rockefeller's death, ensuring the preeminent place of petroleum in the 20th century economy. 60 years after their founder's death, four of the Standard Oil successor firms, Exxon, Mobil, Amoco, and Chevron, numbered among the 50 largest companies on earth. To an extent that would have seemed inconceivable in Ida Tarbell's heyday, the newspaper obituaries dwelled on Rockefeller the benign philanthropist, not Rockefeller the ferocious trust king. He was the world's greatest philanthropist and organizer in the science of giving, said one editorial. Most striking was that the laudatory comments emanated from across the political spectrum and included those who had jousted with him in the past. Attorney Samuel Untermyer issued this paean to the elusive witness he had interrogated. Next to our beloved president, he was our country's biggest citizen. It was he who visualized, as did no other man, the use to which great wealth could wisely be put. Because of him, the world is a better place in which to live. Blessed be the memory of World Citizen Number 1. In truth, John D. Rockefeller Sr. had left behind a contradictory legacy, an amalgam of godliness and greed, compassion and fiendish cunning. He personified the ambiguous heritage of America's Puritan ancestors, who had encouraged thrift and enterprise, but had also spurred overly acquisitive instincts. He had extracted mixed messages from his religious training as well as from his incongruously matched parents. Not surprisingly, he had served as an emblem of both corporate greed and philanthropic enlightenment. Starting in the 1870s, Rockefeller's stewardship of Standard Oil had signaled a new era in American life that had both inspired and alarmed the populace. His unequaled brilliance and rapacity as a businessman had squarely confronted the country with troubling questions about the shape of the economy, the distribution of wealth, and the proper relationship between business and government. Rockefeller perfected a monopoly that indisputably demonstrated the efficiency of large-scale business. In creating new corporate forms, he charted the way for the modern multinational corporations that came to dominate economic life in the 20th century. But in so doing, he also exposed the manifold abuses that could accompany untrammeled economic power, especially in the threat to elected government. As architect of the first great industrial trust, he proved the ultimately fragile nature of free markets, forcing the government to specify the rules that would ensure competition and fair play in the future. The fiercest robber baron had turned out to be the foremost philanthropist. Rockefeller accelerated the shift from the personal ad hoc charity that had traditionally been the province of the rich to something both more powerful and more impersonal. He established the promotion of knowledge, especially scientific knowledge, as a task no less important than giving alms to the poor or building schools, hospitals, and museums. He showed the value of expert opinion, thorough planning, and competent administration in nonprofit work, setting a benchmark for professionalism in the emerging foundation field. By the time Rockefeller died, in fact, so much good had unexpectedly flowered from so much evil that God might even have greeted him on the other side, as the Titan had so confidently expected all along. Although Junior moved into Kaikit after Rockefeller's death, he knew that his father was inimitable, and so he decided to retain the Junior after his name. As he was often heard to say in later years, there was only one John D. Rockefeller. This concludes the reading of Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller Sr. by Ron Chernow. Copyright 1998 by Ron Chernow. This book was read by Grover Gardner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Melanie Jackson Agency, LLC, and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.